This is one way of viewing the piece. It's interesting to me that the screenwriter actually wanted just to write an adventure film that included women. But notice how prominent violence was as a part of that women's adventure. So, and to start with, there are many layers of violence in this particular movie, too. I want us to start with male violence toward women. Some of this will be the most overt stuff. What are the main types of male violence toward women?
Thelma's husband at the beginning, the verbal abuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Daryl is just a jewel, isn't he?
Mm-hmm. Good guy.
And at the beginning, especially, we can see the ambiguity around that. After all, in this verbal abuse, he really didn't call her ugly names or anything like that. It was a much more subtle form that was a language that humiliated her over and over again, almost made her a child in relationship to him. It's apparently so obvious in their relationship that Louise comments on it when they're on the phone and says, you know, Daryl's not your father or something. So verbal abuse is definitely one type of violence in the film. What's another?
Well, the abusiveness of her apparently having set the table for breakfast, prepared breakfast, and he brushes off her efforts, demeaning her, and mm-hmm. just knocking out her self-esteem.
Yeah, which is, maybe instead of calling that verbal abuse, we could call that sort of an emotional kind of abuse.
He seemed to be the type that would want the stereotypical spouse making dinner, etc., you know, staying home, doing those things, but then she would ask, is there anything special you want for dinner? And say, I don't mm-hmm. care what we have for dinner.
Yeah.
Just removing any self-respect or any function from her dinner.
And it's almost as if he had these expectations of Thelma only so that he could use them against her eventually, you know, and twist them around. If she hadn't asked about the meal, or if she hadn't yelled, you know, to be sure he was on time in going to work, and if she hadn't prepared the breakfast and all that sort of stuff, he'd use that as the avenue for emotional and verbal abuse. Anything else? Yeah, that opening scene is pretty interesting with him. What else?
The lewd gestures from the truck driver. Mm-hmm. I guess comments and gestures.
Not that all truckers do this, or that only truckers do this. So if we generalize it, we'll just use trucker to refer to him in what he does. It is an odd phenomenon that Thelma and Louise notice. Are these the kinds of things you say to women you don't even know? You know,
that's
interesting. We'll need to talk about what dynamic there is between men and women, or among men and women, that makes it okay in some people's minds for a male to say and do these sorts of things. It's interesting to watch different behaviors of women in response to this, too, and to see how the repeated patterns of verbal emotional abuse and these sorts of gestures and comments then shape female behavior to accommodate and not exactly accept, but adapt to experiencing these things.
There was the man in the bar that Thelma was dancing with. I have a great problem with this guy. Number one, I believe he he had this plan from the minute he saw her. That was his name, I had forgotten. He definitely had this plan when he said she needed some fresh air. And I don't know which part of no he couldn't understand.
Yeah. Calculating.
And he became terribly physically abusive.
I could almost stop with refusal to hear at all.
Oh, he didn't hear a thing, but yeah. He didn't want to.
Obviously the rape, and not only that, but there was battering in the
yeah.
too.
Right.
Name calling.
Name calling, yeah, you did that.
What a guy. I just liked this man the minute I saw him because he assumed that he could walk up to a table where two women were sitting and he could solve a problem at that table. That their relationship together wasn't seen as complete and fulfilling, and so he could just march right in and clear up all problems with that table of women talking to each other. It's the problem of women who are alone together are perceived as being by themselves. And so culturally, it feels okay for a male to intrude. I've been at bars or at restaurants myself with five or six other women and had a man come up to me and say, "What are you doing here by yourself?" Like I need a keeper, you know, like my master has let me off the chain. I don't know exactly how to name that. We don't have a good name like rape or battering or something, but
Well, it's like your possession.
Just to add to the manipulativeness, I mean, he feigned concern and interest in intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she was naive enough to,
it's a
to
short
get
step.
Some of the stuff she wasn't getting.
Yeah, it's a short step from Harlan's act to the suspicion of the sensitive male, you know, that kind of thing. It's funny, that sometimes I have trouble figuring out what to call some of this, because we participate in it without naming it until it's really a legal problem, don't we? What would I call that?
Well, chauvinism would kind of cover some of it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them.
Yeah, sure.
I think it's a lot of assumptive behavior on the part of the man.
Mm-hmm. Presumption that space holds no boundaries anything.
They assume that everything is okay, you know?
Time Harlan is actually in this movie.
Not
but what's the impact and the symbolism?
Now look at this.
Bring it up for us. Are there other things about Harlan and that part of the movie? Or shall we move on to just post Harlan? What kinds of violence take place after the Harlan episode?
You're talking about male violence, right?
I don't know if you call it male violence, I guess you could sort of, but the fact that they didn't feel like they could go to the police because they wouldn't be heard, they wouldn't be believed, and so
you're
it's
right.
sort of a system error, I guess, but
yeah.
And whatever happened to Louise in Florida, was it?
Texas.
Texas, yeah, they kept referring to this.
Yeah. So maybe we need another category, because it's clear then that not all the violence we're talking about can be attributed to men in a
yeah.
context, but I'm going to call it societal violence.
Although I think even with that societal violence, you can make a point that to some extent it's mostly still male against female, because women don't have much to do with deciding how the legal system is set up.
Right.
And it's prejudicial against women.
So we'll make a note here that we acknowledge that this system that we're talking about includes male privilege and male definitions of what the legal system is. And that we could, I mean, I know that's debatable. Yes, there are women judges. Yes, there are women in the legal system, but by and large, the numbers are vastly imbalanced, and
women
the creators of the system did not include women, by and large. They were not present at the time the system was created. So there's a failure of the legal system itself to take seriously some kinds of crime that involve women. We don't see it in this particular film, but examples like marital rape and domestic violence and the fact that it's so difficult to convince police officers or the judicial system to take stands.
I think there was a lot of marital rape between Daryl and Alma.
There probably was.
Not
confronted, but It might be implied by the fact that she feels
14.
As if she hasn't had a sexual experience before. What's that guy's name?
J.D.
J.D., yeah.
J.D.
Until she encounters that person. Yeah, we can't say for sure that was it. It could just be that she and Daryl just had no chemistry. I don't know. But that's conceivable. Let's see. They were suspicious of the police, and it's the dynamic here of blaming the victim that's a problem here.
And the fact that everyone who poured into her house and everything and all the police officers that were involved were all men. I mean, I wondered to myself, the one guy who seemed to be at least sort of trying to help them, you know, if that were a woman, he felt like a woman to me because he was so ineffective to the rest of the group of men who didn't want to listen and had their ways of dealing with this, you know, kept saying, we know what we're doing, we stay out of this. So just the fact that it was a male-dominated group of people that were dealing with an issue that was hard to judge from a male perspective.
One thing I noticed last night, but not the person I saw, was that Louise almost fell into that trap too. She said, you know, if it weren't for you, we wouldn't be in this mess. And then she realized what she was saying.
I had a third category I thought we would eventually come to today, and this is it. Female violence toward women. And that includes falling in to what the system does, and not even though you were an eyewitness the way Louise was, somehow, you know, getting the sense that it was Thelma's fault. This is probably one of the most painful things for me as someone who does women's studies and work like this, to have a certain class of women who are educated and elite blame other women for the predicaments they find themselves in. That's particularly poignant. What else? Oh, you know one thing that I was thinking that we left out, that we're just coming to sequentially in the movie? What happens when Thelma calls home to try to get Daryl right away?
Bat Fink.
He's out till 4 a.m.
He's out.
Yeah. I don't know what that means. That possibility of marital rape taking place, we don't get in a full-blown way. We don't know what he's doing, but it's clear that there is a disregard for his wife. So I don't know how to put these less tangible things in, because we can imagine two or three scenarios for each one. He could have been having an affair. He could have been out drinking with the guys. He could have been doing any. He could have been at, you know, a porn shop. Who knows where he was?
Well, very early on, she said something about, will you be home, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So this was evidently happening, was it on Friday night?
Yes.
For quite a while.
Premeditated, because I think her surprise that, what is it, the car sales business does so well
on Friday. On Friday night, yeah.
And she suspected that people ought to be doing other things after their work week. What else could we add to this list?
One thing I haven't really been able to label yet, but the interaction between Jimmy and Louise in the hotel when I just remember him knocking everything off the table and tipping the table over, and I guess I thought of it as his way of expressing how he felt. I mean, it was sort of a...
Jimmy is an example of a kind of intimidation, maybe. And there's a powerful difference between what is permissible in our culture with respect to this kind of behavior by males and by females. There's quite a difference. Anything else? I mean, my list still goes on. I've got more.
Yeah, it was in some ways like he was trying to let his needs be known, and yet he didn't know how to do it.
It's confusing, isn't it? Because I'm one of those people who really wants to affirm that people should, you know, state their needs and the intensity of their needs, that they should be able to be really angry when they are really angry. And how is it that sometimes we have a gut reaction and we know that someone has gone beyond expressing a need and expressing anger, and it's become something else? It's an intangible space, and depending upon where you draw the line, one side is violent or experienced as violence, and the other side is just a normal behavior.
Well, I think becoming angry is probably, no, it is. It's very healthy to become angry. However, you don't become so angry that you hurt anyone, either emotionally or physically.
Yeah.
And this is what happened in this movie. Jimmy's knocking the table over was okay. You know, he was not hurting her, but it's the, Jimmy knew what he was going to do from the minute he saw those girls.
Jimmy or J.D.?
J.D., I mean, yeah. J.D. did know. He really did know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why didn't I think he was a college student?
College student trying to get home or get back to school or wherever it was going.
The fact that it appears to be calculated. This is a guy who has a routine, apparently. I mean, he does his robbery stuff. You know, he has a system down.
But he did tell her, and she still walked away and left, you know, the money on the table.
Yeah, he had her pegged.
He did have her pegged.
I guess the two things that frustrate us are that he did steal the money, and even though it sounds as if she had the night of her life sexually,
Yeah.
I don't know if she ever felt this way, but I thought, boy, would I feel used.
Right.
When it was all over, both sexually and physically with them.
Well, but he even told her how he went about it. I mean, that he sort of sat back and looked at the situation, you know, and cased it out beforehand, and that's exactly what he was doing.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting about this? This is exactly what leads women to become very frustrated with other women. Mm-hmm. It becomes very easy to blame Thelma. Oh, come on, get a clue. You know? How many signals do you need from the mouth of the person who is doing this, you know, before you can stand up and say, there's something wrong here. I'm being violated in some way. There's a fourth category, I think, that's worth thinking about, and it's female violence toward ourselves. And I don't have a good name for that either, since it's not a crime. But it's when I know it when I see it. If I'm with a woman and I watch her suddenly, in the presence of someone else, become a blank face. I watch an intelligent woman suddenly become naive. I'm at a restaurant, I'm having a serious discussion with a woman, and suddenly she becomes coquettish because a male has walked. And I wonder, what happened to this woman's brain in that split second? You know, what chemical response, you know, is responsible for that? And we're taught to do that, it seems to me, from the time we're children, we get rewards. You know, the father gives us candy when we become compliant. And then before long, we don't need the candy. To suddenly shift our personalities into that mode. And I don't know. I put that it's becoming blank or something.
I sort of see Thelma that way because, you know, I have to admit, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, she's just been, it wasn't clear to me whether she was actually raped or if it was kind of stopped in the middle there. I wasn't sure how far it got, but I'm like, you know, this man tried to rape her less than 24 hours ago, and now she's opening herself up to this another huckster. I mean, that just seemed really, you know, and I don't know if I'm blaming her, but it just doesn't seem normal to me, or not normal, but rational or reasonable that she would do that.
We saw that in a number of times with Louise, too, where she was almost at the point of coming through. And, well, even in the situation with Jimmy, you know, she couldn't go with what she really wanted to. She just kind of shut herself off, her feelings off at that point.
That's a good word for it. It's almost like there's a switch. Mm-hmm. And one minute you're a whole functioning self, and the next minute the switch goes off.
Yeah, you lose your sense of self. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. With Thelma, you'd probably have to go back to her situation at home to figure out, you know, what was it about her that, you know, to where she would stay married to Daryl, you know, under those kinds of circumstances, because it would have had to have started before him, you know, that cycle. Or
yeah, this was not a match made in heaven. I would call it a match made by culture.
Yeah.
She did exactly what the female is supposed to do. He did exactly what the male is supposed to do. You know? I mean, when you think about it, Daryl just lived up to his obligations as the culture has trained him to. You know, to be strong, to be the decision maker, to be the one who goes to work, to be the one who has freedom and independence while she is trained to be the dependent one, the one who caters to his needs. And she does it very well. I mean, from her dress and her mannerisms to her capacity to erase herself in order that he might be the strong self in their pairing. Perfect. I mean, how do you fault people when they are just doing what they've been trained to do? That's one of the requirements.
Like Louise calls Thelma on that once in the car when she says, "Are you going to Mexico with me or not?" You know, and you keep shutting off when we have to make these decisions, but don't do it now. You have to stay with me here.
Yeah, it's hard to do that. I mean, I've had to do that with friends. I had a friend who was my housemate. She was planning to get married. 2 weeks before she got married, her fiancé beat her up. And I sat her down and I said, "Marty, what can you be thinking?" We talked until 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning about this event. And she admitted, "I don't really love this man. I am just almost 40 years old, and I feel that if I don't take this chance to get married, I will never be married." She had a whole host of reasons. We came to consensus at the end that this was a very unhealthy relationship for her. The next afternoon, about 2 in the afternoon, she walked in with her wedding invitations, and all excited and giddy, and saying, "Look, Nancy, the wedding invitations came. Isn't this exciting? I can start addressing them tonight." And I thought, wait a minute. Where was I overnight? Was I dreaming this while we were up this whole time? And what was odd about it is it caused a rift between Marty and me, and not between Marty and Tom, that we had this discussion and this conflict between us, that she could shut off the next day and pretend that none of this had ever happened.
How are they now?
I saw her about 3 weeks ago. They're divorcing.
That's kind
they
of
were
hard.
Married about 2.5-3 years, something like that. So, but this is a perfectly intelligent woman. This is a woman who teaches school. You know, she has a mind. She has been independent for 37 years of her life, even without a mother to take care of her for most of it. But this capacity to totally erase the self and let cult society or someone else take over. And so that you just reflect what's going on. This is a problem.
One thing that bothered me, I don't know what to call this or what it is either, but a number of times Thelma, especially when things went wrong, they get in the car, and her comfort to herself is to put on makeup. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And it just drove me nuts.
Yeah, what?
You know, like everything is falling apart. And, she opens up her compact. What a screwed up thing if the first thing on your mind is, at least I can look all right.
Yeah. I ended up putting that in a couple of categories as I was thinking through that. And, what's embarrassing to me is I didn't even think about it the first couple of times I saw the movie, and some of my students decided they were going to do a careful analysis of it. And that was one of the main things they pointed out. One of the types of societal violence, I call the beauty myth. That there's a certain way you ought to look. And the consequence of that is, I guess, the whole makeup culture. And I don't know what to call it when I do it to myself either, but it becomes... or when I watch someone else do it up, like Tammy Faye Baker or something. I think, what is that? I wonder if it fits with that erasing of the self. You know, is it a part of putting the mask on so that I appear to be the proper female and then ignore who I am? I have this wonderful friend who is an out lesbian feminist scholar of religion. And she and I were very close in graduate school, and then it came time for, she finished her dissertation, she interviewed for jobs, and she said, "Well, it's time for me to wear skirts and makeup now." And I said, "Tess, you don't want to erase yourself. Do you want to spend a lifetime working with a mask on that is not you at all?" And so after the interview part, she gave it up. So I was kind of relieved about that. And so when I see her at professional meetings now, she saw through what she was doing very quickly. But it is an odd thing. And while it doesn't happen in this movie, it's exactly what leads to most excessive forms of violence against ourselves, like eating disorders. I'll put it in parentheses, since Thelma and Louise don't seem to have that problem. I don't know. But. Well, how women look becomes very important. And the irony is that women are expected to look a certain way in this film, which is culturally sanctioned. And then that's what leads to blaming the victim, too.
I thought it was really kind of an interesting thing for the movie people to do. They contrasted Thelma and Louise's looks at the bar scene. I mean, Louise was covered up and matronly, and it's almost like she was reacting to maybe what happened in Texas or whatever.
Yeah, Louise is much more guarded and severe looking.
Yeah, I was going to say, the makeup thing can go both ways. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, by refusal to use any, you're negating yourself.
That's right.
Also, I was thinking of my mother, who used no makeup at all, and it was like she couldn't honor herself or be in touch with herself.
It does work both ways. So maybe it's good that there isn't quotation marks there, because either for lack of self-esteem, or for cultural role-playing, we get involved with it. It is a matter of, the contrast would be, the healthy thing might be, to have the freedom to decide, you know, without feeling external pressures about that.
You know, the thing about Thelma and Louise, and maybe this is getting ahead a little bit, but I thought it was interesting how they switched a little bit physically.
Yes.
Thelma started wearing Louise's clothes. She put on her jacket.
Her jacket,
her black jacket.
The studs on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Louise eventually let her hair down. Mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting how they started to look like each other and act like each other a little bit.
And as a part of that too, one of the striking things at the end of the movie is when they do that retrospective
on
their looks. And what we see are these two, first of all, these two beautiful women who, without makeup, and who, in an odd sense of self-confidence born out of their adventures and their crimes, look more beautiful than they did when we see them with their makeup and their role-playing before. It's kind of striking when you look at them.
And Thelma certainly would not have worn that tanker driver's cap ever before in her life.
Oh, no, ever.
Yeah. Something begins to radiate from herself at that point, which defines what is beauty for her, and it's easy to recognize when it comes out. I don't know, have we gotten all the major things that take place?
There's one other that I noticed particularly, because my dad was always this way with my mom and I. If we ever go on a trip, you know, they brought so much stuff just in case of this, just in case of this, because there were two women traveling alone, and that's why they brought the gun, and that's why her husband made her have a gun in the first place, even though she refused to use it. Mm-hmm. And just the fact of the fear of going out by yourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. That's one of the cross-cutting sort of things, too, but maybe we could call that something that really fits into society, that whole sense of fear. Now, one thing I have to acknowledge here is that I could go through the same list, and if we talked about male violence toward males and male violence towards selfhood, a lot of these same things would appear. The issue here is that it's so disproportionate in the case of women. For example, statistics are hard to find on in the male case, but there are some estimates that as many as 1 in 10 men can report having been raped during their lives. Most of the time it was when they were boys. But it's quite a different thing to hear that about approximately 1/4 of women can report that they've been raped. Why such a disproportionate difference in the number of rape assaults toward women, and you can go through statistics on other things.
Nancy, I live down in Monterey County, California, and what the statistics we hear there is that 80% of women over in especially the coastal part of Monterey County have been raped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, and
a lot of that's date rape, I think.
Well, I don't know.
Which is
still rape.
Yeah.
Right.
And while maybe one of the terms we ought to fit in here, maybe Harlan really thought of this more as a date for him.
Mm-hmm. I had the feeling, though, that if this had not been Thelma, it would have been another woman.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, anyone who was convenient.
Waitress.
The waitress, you could tell, had known Harlan
You're right.
a long time, and he was a real sleazeball, and I believe Harlan was married besides, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you could tell that Harlan just viewed this as part of his responsibility in society and just be this mm-hmm. predator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Verlana and I were talking yesterday about how these are not just cultural expectations that affect women, but male power is tied into virility and conquest of women. There is a sense in which Harlan is a victim here of his own circumstances. Not that we want to reward that kind of behavior, you know, by saying, well, too bad, poor Harlan, you know, he's just looking for it. But yeah, you're right. Since this was my probably 1 millionth time watching this movie for educational purposes, last night I saw something that I never retained before after the movie was over, but it really irritated me last night not the good cop guy that we liked because he was on Thelma and Louise's side, but the other one, the stiff-necked sort of guy. While they're waiting around at Daryl's house for the phone to ring.
Football.
Well, football's, of course, one thing, but he's reading some porn magazine.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
yes.
Yes.
You also notice they never shut the TV off most of the time. It's as if Daryl, really what's more important to Daryl is the male image of, like, sports. I sit around when I have my free time, and the police didn't seem to impress upon him the seriousness of the fact that his wife was involved in a crime. And they just let the sporting event go on, as typical men would do.
Yeah, and we don't know what month it was. It could have been Super Bowl Sunday. Could have been really important.
When that same guy, when they were telling Daryl, okay, when she calls, make it sound like you're concerned about her. Women love that shit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That seemed like his attempt to try to speak Daryl's language.
Which one said to Daryl trying to make her?
That stiff neck.
The guy, he was just part of the whole system of male dominance.
But don't they eventually dominate Daryl? I mean, at some point, Daryl is kind of totally dominated by all the men that are there.
Yeah, with the movie
station. Yeah, because then they don't let him watch what he wants,
right?
They kind of take over their
left. Yeah, that was a real subtle hint that mm-hmm. men are violent toward each other mm-hmm. in a controlled way.
Yeah. It's almost as if, though, too, at the same time that they are sort of controlling Daryl, there's this part of him that seems to feel honored. Look at all the attention I'm getting, mm-hmm. too. So he's getting some strokes out of it, even if he doesn't get to watch sports.
Question. This may seem obvious, but could we try to define violence?
Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
You read my notes. I can't imagine getting too many more things out of that movie, but this is pretty good, isn't it? I mean, this movie then it becomes a really powerful case study in what violence is, and it does note that when you do a film about women, violence plays a dominant role in the film, even when it's a film about women and not about men. That's what's interesting. And we have really worked around a definition of violence, I think. We ought to think about what it means.
Nancy, was the escape mode that these two women were in at the beginning of the film, could that have been violence toward themselves? They were actually getting away rather than facing, rather than handling the situation, both of them.
It's probably a debatable topic, isn't it? I wrestle with it internally.
Yeah.
Were they giving up power? Or that's were they claiming
yeah, that's
their
what
power?
I could not decide.
I don't know.
Yeah. Weren't they going to Mexico?
Mm-hmm. Well, they were after they got in trouble, but not at the beginning. Were they at the beginning?
No,
they weren't. They were going to the mountains or something.
Yeah.
Or so they said.
I have a hard time figuring out how to relate to that part of the movie exactly. I think where I'm left is in ambiguity, and that's mm-hmm. probably where I ought to be. Because it seems to me Thelma and Louise were in a lose-lose situation.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter which course they took, they were going to be accomplices in what violence was done to them. If they had done what I would have done as a typical good girl, I'd have called the police. And I'd be sent up the river, probably. You know, is that real freedom? Is that really claiming my power? If I had made the other choice, I'd just have been inviting a different kind of violence toward myself. I don't know, it'd be a hard choice.
But you know what, even this is not murder, it's rape. My daughter, my oldest daughter's best friend was brutally raped. And it was a hung jury. Mm-hmm. Three other women came forward after the trial, and the district attorney wanted to retry this man. And Peggy said, I cannot put myself through that again. She was on trial.
Yes. Yeah.
She was on trial, actually more than he was on trial.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll do it again.
That's right, yeah. So, and that's the dilemma we're in.
That's
the
dilemma.
Ambiguity. And yeah. One last kind of violence in this movie.
mm-hmm.
It was a choice. Do I do the violence to myself,
yeah,
or do I let someone else do it to me? Mm-hmm. Either through the legal system, or as a result of being hunted down like a criminal, or which is more empowering, to kill yourself or let somebody else do it? You know, that's the hard choice. So I have very mixed feelings about the ending too. Where in what respects is it claiming power, in what respects is it losing power?
I think it's a violence to the fact that Louise killed him. I don't know how to put this, let's see. I think she, you know, she bought into this culture of violence.
Mm-hmm.
She killed him, but I think that was a violence against herself also, because mm-hmm. she was driven to do something that maybe wasn't yeah. part of her or...
Mm-hmm. Maybe so, yeah.
She killed him not immediately, but after he made that last mm-hmm. remark,
yeah. mm-hmm.
that was what did it.
Well, it was a societal violence thing before that.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The surface.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe a way to describe that kind of violence is the violence that comes from silencing. Like in the Rodney King case. You know, we've seen it. You know, Rodney King is not an isolated incident. I lived in L.A. County. There were a million Rodney Kings, you know, who were violently abused by the police system there. It was just in the case of Rodney King, the continuous silencing and voicelessness of a people erupted. Maybe that societal and violence, societal violence includes being voiceless. And then when you finally erupt in the rage that is justified, then there's further violence yeah. toward you yeah. for finally expressing what had been silenced all along. I do want to get to the question of what is violence. How do we typically define the word violence?
Harming someone else.
Physical. Frequently physical harm.
Emotional harm is just as bad.
We're becoming much more sensitive about emotional and psychological forms of harm. We think of it as a kind of abuse or assault, usually some kind of battering. And for that reason, you know, all the wonderful statistics that we have to toss around. I've been at two conferences lately that have had to do with abuse. These kinds of things are what people typically write about, and they reflect what people will call abuse. One third of women will be abused somehow. Half of women live with partners who are abusive to them. And every 15 seconds, a woman is battered. I mean, start counting that off. Those are huge numbers. One-fourth of women will be raped. One-sixth of them will be raped while they're in college. That scares me as someone who's around these women all the time. Every 6 minutes, a rape is committed. One-fourth of those college women, one-fourth of women in college will experience being raped or will experience attempted rape. One-seventh of married women are victims of marital rape. Half of the victims of sexual abuse are under age 11. Huge numbers, and these are conservative numbers. I've actually seen higher, you know, this is, some of these come from the Center for the Prevention of Sexual and Domestic Violence, from Eldon Olson, who did some evaluation of reporting and non-reported crime. Those are the typical ways we understand violence. It's clear that before we got very far into this project, that we had begun to define violence a little differently, or to expand the definition of violence. How did we do that?
Say again.
We moved beyond that limited definition of violence. We moved beyond murder and rape and assault, battering and such things as our typical understanding of battering. We even moved beyond verbal and emotional forms of abuse to something else. How did we make some subtle shifts? How many people, except for Rodney King and cohorts, how many people think of the police and the legal system as doing violence? You know, how did we shift it?
How many of you remember the riot in Watts? That, as far as I can remember, that's the first time I remember violence against a police system.
Mm-hmm. The acknowledgement that
right.
The system is.
But at the same time, my nephew has a friend who became a professional baseball player, and he lived in Watts. And Dave said, because of his color, if he was walking down the street after dark, it was not alone very common to be stopped and searched by a policeman. Mm-hmm. It was very common to get the heck beat out of you, mm-hmm. just because you were there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not right.
Yeah, and it gets worse than that. I read James Cone a lot. James Cone is a black theologian who's one of my personal heroes. And he said he gets really tired of the white system always asking blacks why they're so violent.
Oh, yeah.
He said, you know, he says it's obvious that there has been literal violence against black people, like, for example, the beating of the Rodney King, or a history of raping black women, you know, who then produce mixed-race children. He says, but what about the other violence that the white system does to us? You know, by keeping mm-hmm. us out of good schools, by denying us jobs once we are educated, you know, finding all kinds of ways to discriminate. Cone is one of those people moving us toward a fuller definition of violence, I think. that includes systemic forms rather than just these overt, obvious kinds of things. I think my students helped to point this out to me. You know, if you want to learn something, put students in charge of it. Don't do it yourself. I also. I had this very good class except for all my students were white in a class I did on liberation theology, except for one Hispanic student. No, and there was one Chinese-American woman. And we were dealing with how violence erupts in Latin America around an unjust system. Well, naturally, all my good Lutheran Christian folks started talking about nonviolence. Boy, those people ought to find a way to bring about nonviolent revolution. You know, this is really fun. A couple of my students started arguing about it regularly. One of my students had been to Mexico a lot. And he sort of thought, well, you know, some of this violence is justified. And another student said, well, I don't know, peace is possible. They set up a simulation game for us. Certain people were part of the Labor Party. Another group was a Christian family. Then there was a base Christian community meeting. Knowing how peace-oriented I am, they made me head of the military. Yeah. That was great. And I was just, even though I was head of the military, I was just a pawn to some faceless set of commands that came to me about violent acts we would do. Well, on our first raid, my army and I went in with our guns. We had sport guns. We had real weapons for this. And we went in and kidnapped the son of the Christian family. The next raid we went in, and the Christian family had joined the base Christian community and the labor movement. They had all come together in solidarity. And we walked in the room, and the first person to pick up the gun was the mother, who had been placed in that role by my students because she was the most peace-oriented one in the room. What an interesting exercise in what breeds violence. Violence breeds violence. And it doesn't just come from the fact that military people come in and shoot. It comes from the fact that you have been poor all your life, and that is violence itself. Or you have been discriminated against, or you have been belittled, or you have been humiliated. And the lesson the students wanted to teach us is that the word violence is also connected with the word violate. They did some research, same Latin root, basically. And what they wanted to teach us was that when you violate, you desecrate something. In other words, you strip it of its sacredness, and its wholeness, and its value. And that seems to be the reason that we can move so easily into naming violence as the refusal to hear, or being manipulative, or presuming things, crossing boundaries. You know, maybe it's no big deal, but it's interesting for me to look out at a classroom full of students sometimes and see that when, here's what's interesting. Women will sit like this with a very narrow space defined for where they place their notes. And then some of the guys, you know, right next to that woman will be kind of like this. Is that not a form of violence? The sense that I don't have to be concerned that another person is being crowded. Having her space violated. Mm-hmm. Is she such an object in the room like the desk next to me that I can touch her or her desk as if it were my own? Yeah. That's the thing the students were trying to show us. Not only is violence a violation of space and sacredness of human person, but it does literally come down to the violation of rights. That was a part of the definition of the word violate.
And then when a female scrolls and touches, then it has an altogether different connotation. It's not violating a space. It's, what are you doing?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Then she's a tramp. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then we go into the whole blaming the victim routine. Sort of the house that Jack built. One act leads to another. It's a very interesting to watch these dynamics. I can't tell you how helpful it was for me to have students who had the courage to raise these questions and show us the violence in each other. You know, even the good, peaceful Lutherans began to realize what violence they perpetuate. I, as the teacher who is always committed to justice, have pointed out to me where I do violence too. If I don't continually have the sacredness of another human being in my eyesight along the way. If we look at those kinds of definitions of violence, we can expand a bit what we learn from Thelma and Louise. We can continue to add to our list over here of overt forms of violence, things that include murder of women. When I lived in Chicago, in the mid-70s, someone ran around the Hyde Park, the neighborhood where I lived, and put a red X on every site where a woman had been murdered. Do you know how spooky it is walking around the place where you live and work when you have to cross a red X every few blocks? You know that, and I just lived 10 blocks from work. You know, and if I took a different route home, I'd cross another, you know, 10 more, and it could be me who was one of those X's. If we talk about male violence against women, we can include rape, date rape, battering, sexual harassment, all kinds of sexual and physical abuse of girls. What else? I think of murder especially. This powerful example. Remember the incident in Canada not that long ago where the male engineering student walked in and mass murdered some female students claiming that they were feminist? That's a kind of violence that includes not just aggression toward these particular women, but toward a movement that says that women have a right to become, to come into voice. You know, so that's pretty scary stuff. If we go to female violence of women towards women, here's some new things we can add. Racism. The sense that I always know what is best for all women, because I'm an educated white female member of the elite class, and therefore I ought to be able to tell African women what would be most liberating for them. It's been very painful for those of us who write in women's studies to find out that we have been doing the same violence toward women that men have been doing to us, because we have made all women look alike and have all the same needs. Elitism is a part of that. That's a kind of violence I participate in. Homophobia of women toward lesbian women is another kind of violence. And we really have named a lot of the violence against self, things like anorexia, bulimia, eating disorders, falling prey to the beauty myth, doing all kinds of self-monitoring of our behavior so we continue to be submissive kinds of people. The legal system, the whole blaming the victim mentality that is associated with that. Pornography is one of the types. Medicine, interestingly enough, is a place I've discovered in my work in women's studies as a place of violence toward women. You ever thought about childbirth? And the very procedures that we use in this country, in the U.S. medical profession, to get childbirth, do violence to women's bodies. You know, the whole posture that we place women in actually is for the convenience of the doctor, not for the ease of childbirth. Keeping the woman confined to a space on a bed is for the convenience of the hospital staff, when it would be more comfortable for her to move and would probably make the birth easier. Saying that she must dilate a certain amount by a certain time or there will be interventions refuses to acknowledge the differences between women and their physiology. I've read some very painful descriptions of such things. The fact that medical research has not really taken account of female statistics in doing work on such things as heart disease, for example, so that when women go to the doctor and they have pains in their chest, it's assumed that it's something else. It can't be serious. Men have heart disease, women don't. So the medical profession has built in it certain violence toward women, including various things that I would call first world mutilations of women, like radical mastectomies that are unnecessary and hysterectomies that are performed, a cesarean section, you know, performed unnecessarily. And of course, our favorite type of societal violence against women lately is best exemplified in Nita Hill Clarence Thomas hearing on sexual harassment, societal violence, which not only is sort of blind to what the crime is, but further humiliates in the process, like we were saying is true of rape cases.
This happened to a female, she was a teaching neurosurgeon at Stanford, not that long ago. She finally reported the sexual harassment that she was undergoing, even in OR when she was working, from the other doctors. Mm-hmm. And this shouldn't happen.
Yeah. At least this has been an important time to educate, to explain why it may take 10 to 15 years before a woman can report an incident of sexual harassment. It takes that long to establish yourself in a career so that you are no longer threatened financially in terms of your well-being in your profession. Boy, you know, I was during the Clarence Thomas and Nita Hill incident, I was talking to some women colleagues, and I said, did you know graduate students who were harassed by faculty where you teach? And most of them said, well, you know, not really. And then we talked about what it really is. And then my friend Susan said, hey, wait a minute. I do remember it, but I buried it so deep that I can hardly remember it because I had to survive. Mm-hmm. I was already $30,000 in debt for graduate school education. If I had crossed my dissertation advisor, that would have been $30,000 down the drain, and I wouldn't have been employable because who can get a job without a dissertation? So I'd have been waiting tables to try to pay back the student loan of $30,000, which I can tell you from experience is big dollars per month. It's a matter of survival not to do reporting in some cases. It's the ambiguity of not knowing how to exist.
I was in a meeting of women that I thought would have been very supportive of Anita Hill after the decision was made. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't believe, I think I was the only one in there that supported her. Mm-hmm. So I think the feeling of women in that situation was very strange.
Yeah. I had a friend that worked in a lawyer's office during that, and they took a straw poll. Most of the women, the officer secretaries, and most of the men were the lawyers. And who do you think supported Anita Hill? It wasn't the women.
It was the lawyers.
It was the lawyers. The women did support Thomas. Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. I listened to KPLU, as any good Pacific Lutheran University professor should, and heard on NPR a report that two women anthropologists at, I think it was Case Western Reserve, have done a new study surveying women about whether they believed Anita Hill or not. And what was interesting is that going into it, into the interviews, women were, the majority of women were inclined to say they did not support Anita Hill. But through a series of questions which asked them to define what sexual harassment was and led them to understand what the experience is, at the end of the interview, when they were asked again, do you believe Anita Hill was telling the truth? 75% of the women said they believed Anita Hill, once they came to understand the dynamics of sexual harassment. Now, I'd like to see that study. I want to see how many, I don't have the data. It may be they talked to an insignificant number of women. It may be that the questions were really leading questions, which manipulated the responses, because they did face-to-face interviews, which makes a difference. Spending half an hour with each woman. So, I don't know what to make of that, but it's kind of interesting that their study may just show that it requires a coming to consciousness of some sort before you can recognize what sexual harassment is.
really is.
I have just a couple of further questions. As in the case of Anita Hill and other incidents, I'm interested to try to figure out why is it so difficult to see some of the forms of violence that we've talked about? Why is it difficult to admit them and to name them? You know, it's interesting that sometimes we were struggling with just trying to find the right words for some of it. And do we think that it's particularly difficult for men to be able to recognize and name violence toward women? And why do women become complicit? I'm looking for the big picture, which helps us to deal with our denial of violence, whether it's male or female, participating in that process. Do you have any ideas about why it's difficult for us?
Well, the popular culture and some women's roles in that, like for example, Madonna, mm-hmm. has done more to cement in the objectification of women than, mm-hmm. you know, and she set us back, you know, years. And that's coming from certain women, some women.
Yeah. So in that case, for example, we're probably raising a whole generation of young 20-year-olds and mm-hmm. high school girls who think that this is the way to be a powerful woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at least this way I have some control over men. You know, and so they make themselves into objects, not realizing that the twist on it is that it empowers men in certain ways. Yeah,
well. It seems to be our survival is somehow tied into violence, into how we can inflict our will or our purpose on someone else to get what we want. I mean, just to live is to do violence. We don't know of any other way to live without. I mean, all the stuff you mentioned, if everyone stopped doing that today, we just would be standing in our tracks. I mean, what do you do? Where do you go if you don't? Everything implies violence.
And like the women who initially supported Clarence Thomas, some of that, I think, is fear. Because if you look at Anita Hill and think, oh yeah, she was, you know, she was harassed. Well, then you have to look at yourself and see just this web of violence and harassment around you, and then you can't go on with this illusion of, I don't know, normalcy or, mm-hmm. you know, that we treat each other well. Or, I mean, I would think it's fear and not wanting to face that it's in our own lives, that it's done to us, and that maybe we do it to other people.
Yeah, the sheer scope of it could be paralyzing.
Right.
Yeah. It was so many levels, but the fact that we have fashioned our society as a competitive society, mm-hmm. which begins with the educational system that we now grow.
Yeah.
And the way you get and maintain power and wealth and so forth is by getting involved in a system, or being involved in a system, or inheriting a system, or being born into a system that puts you in that place. And then masks the violence that's done to its victims. You know, we all know that today 40,000 people will die of starvation. You know, that's violence. And it makes even some of these other things, my own mind, seem rather minor. Or the fact that we have a world system that literally keeps 2/3 of the world in poverty. That's violence. And then you begin to bring it to our own country with the same kinds of analogies, or then you get involved in the racism issues, or as we're talking today, in terms of the violence of a particularly patriarchal society has to women. It's, I mean, to break out of that is going to be an incredible, because we're going to have to find a whole different way of living together. It's going to have to do with cooperation and not competitiveness and egalitarian values and all kinds of stuff that are just foreign to the whole capitalistic competitive society that fashion plans. I don't know how, it just seems overwhelming to me.
It is overwhelming. And what's interesting is that the three of you who've just spoken sort of bring up two really significant points. One is the fact that our culture gives mixed messages about some things. Exactly the thing we define as success has as a cost violence to somebody else. And I guess we, as a society, we have to become people who does sort of a cost analysis on what we do, what we define as good and valuable and important, including the American dream. We have to take that whole thing apart. The other important thing I hear you saying is that certainly power, and maybe even more specifically privilege, are ideas that we have to reassess. And they are things that mask our, and both of these things actually are things that mask our ability to see the violence that we do, to distance ourselves, to make into objects the poor, the homeless, women, minorities, handicapped people, gay and lesbian people. I could go on and on, because it would be, for one thing, it would be too painful for us to see the violence that we do. And other times I think we are truly unconscious of what we're doing. There was an incident in my graduate school when a man and a woman were seeing each other socially and sexually, and they had a falling out. Bruce was working with Lynn at one point, and during a busy conference, they were doing collating and stapling of papers, you know, a standard task. Bruce wanted to talk, sensitive male that he is. He wanted to work out their differences. He's, you know, going into the let's be friends stuff. Lynn was still very angry about what happened between them. Lynn told him she didn't want to talk to him. She turned quickly to leave the room. He grabbed her from behind. Just grabbed her arms, spun her around and said, "We've got to talk." Lynn cried rape, literally, in that moment, to try to bring someone into this room where she was alone with a man, and brought charges of sexual harassment against Bruce. As someone who knew them both, who actually employed them both, I was director of a research center, they both worked for me, I had quite a dilemma on my hands. Two people coming to me with similar stories in terms of the chronology of the events, but totally different feelings about what had actually gone on. And I have my own interpretation about what the dynamics were there. But one thing that Bruce and I really had to talk out as an employer to an employee was, Bruce, because there are serious power differences between men and women, you can never grab a woman that way and not be perceived as, and not really risk being perceived as doing violence. Bruce had very great difficulty seeing that. He saw himself as just being sincere, refusing to let Lynn drop the subject and erase him from her set of relationships. But that's a very real difference in our perceptions, and it comes mostly from the difference in power that we experience.
Had the situation been reversed, and she wanted to talk, and he didn't, and as he turned his back on her, she hit him.
Would there have been anything he could have called it?
Or he'd hit her back.
No.
He wouldn't have hit her back.
No, Bruce wouldn't have done that. Yeah, that's another ugly side to this, isn't it? That I don't know. Bruce clearly was in a lose-lose situation all the way around, I think.
Well, going back to the point of the, I think we're so uncomfortable in this society talking about things that are real, very emotional. And I think the more successful, crust of society, if you want to put it that way, especially out in the business world, a man who's successful in business never wants to admit that there's anything going wrong either in his home or in the society around him. I think we're very, and same way would be true of his wife, to really talk about things that were real is very difficult.
This is what I was hearing in this situation you were talking about. What I don't like was the woman's maybe inability to talk this out. I don't believe you ever solve anything by not talking.
But at the same time, he could respect her.
Yeah, he should have.
To talk at
but what time. What I mean is, if she, somewhere along the line, and I don't know, maybe it happened in childhood, maybe it happened in their relationship, but the fact that she could not talk to him was bad news from the word go.
Yeah. What's interesting is that in Lynn's case, it was a product of a history of violence toward her.
Okay.
Her mother was an alcoholic. Lynn was adopted by this alcoholic mother, who, and her mother was married to seven different men during Lynn's childhood. Lynn learned to be very flirtatious, very enticing to men. She was really into this erasing herself stuff and makeup, and she would spend hours planning what to wear during the day because she wanted to have a particular effect on a particular man at a particular hour of the day. She used to make me crazy about that. And then if a man got close to her, she'd push him away. You know, Lynn had her own problems that resulted from a history of violence. Bruce played right into it in making her feel violated again, even though, I mean, we have this whole cycle now. We are just sort of trapped in this whirlpool of violence and responses to violence. And as Scott says, it's going to take some really hard work to figure out how to redesign ourselves around this. I think Brian and Scott.
I was just going to say that we all know people who are not violent, who don't seem to have what we would call any fight in them. And we know what happens to them. And we don't want to be those people. Mm-hmm. You know, I look at old footage of the Civil Rights Movement, and I see those people just get beat. And for what? You know, 30 years later, what does it mean? Mm-hmm. You know, and you don't have to be political about it. You can just see it. And we all know that if you don't have any fight in you, you don't get anywhere in this country anyway. I certainly can't speak for other countries, and we don't want to be at the bottom.
As I've tried to brood on this, I just have some real kind of wandering thoughts about it, but not very systematic. It feels to me like one of the gifts that women are bringing now to us is a new consciousness about violence. They're bringing it not only to men, but hopefully it begins to get pushed out, to, as we've been doing, is many other definitions. We're also, now I think there's a difference between being violent and being feisty. Or being
passionate,
yeah, or something. I'm struggling for the words, but I mean, I don't think we want to interpret this. And I think this gets, when men get together and start talking about this, this is one of their struggles, because they many times feel like they've now been presented with all these rules and regulations, and they can't say anything or do anything, or they're going to be out of line and out of order, and they want to be sensitive, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's kind of zapping the passion out of them or something. But because certainly our own creativity in solving this problem is going to take incredible feistiness on the part of us. I mean, if we're going to reorganize, begin to take on the privilege, which includes taking on ourselves, but not only ourselves, but the systems we live in that we didn't create, but it have victimized all kinds of people in our own society and clearly around the world. We can't become wimpy about this, which means that we have to be able to say the wrong thing and do the wrong thing and with each other and somehow or another work through that.
Yeah, be able to talk about it.
Be able to talk about it. And, and so it's interesting. I just got yesterday this thing from John Magnuson, the campus ministry. He'd gone to hear, what's her name? I think of my glasses. Paglia.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Gracious.
Gracious. Camellia.
Yeah.
Paglia. And there's a bunch of quotes from her, which are very interesting.
That's one of the examples of violence of women towards women.
What?
That's one of the examples of violence of women.
Yeah,
towards
I mean, she has a comment here about Eva Hill that I had never heard before. But I mean, you know, it goes on and on. I've not heard her speak, but I've been out of the circuit here for a long time. So apparently she's a popular. She draws a crowd, anyway.
She draws a crowd. Yeah, we can say that. It's kind of like Phyllis Schlafly draws a crowd now. There are as many people in the audiences who go there to pay her.
Oh, I see.
To hear her about Pauline. Uh-huh.
Well, it does say she comes with body carriage or something.
Mm-hmm. She's that offensive. Yeah.
Yeah, a short, hot-blooded Italian. Yeah. Professor of humanities. She comes with. She travels with security guards.
Yeah. We're approaching 10:30 here, and I know that your coffee break timer is going off internally. Let's finish up here.
One of the questions was why we were having difficulty putting these words down. And something that interests me in studying any language, can an idea exist without the term for it? And it seems to be backed up by that study, if we decided it's valid, that the women going into the interview did not necessarily agree with Anita Hill or believe Anita Hill. Once they understood the term, they could put a name on something that they had seen and experienced, but until then, until we have words for things that we are trying to name, it's hard to get people to see them.
Yeah. That's one reason I've entitled every section I'm doing something about naming. Mm-hmm. I think it's really significant to see that our language does violence. Mm-hmm. That how easily we can come up with words like rape, murder, sexual harassment, you know, which is a new one. Mm-hmm. You know, we can come up with those. But when we try to talk about the more subtle things that we feel, we're at a loss for words. If we try to talk about different ways of connecting with people that are not violent, it's difficult to find the words for what that will be. Because I think if we succumb to anything I've said in some of my writing, it will be to a lack of imagination. that we simply gave up and decided we could not imagine what it would be like to do things differently, and therefore we didn't.
One area that I see violence in that we haven't mentioned yet, and it's an area I think we go to for comfort and security and spirituality, is the church. I mean, it has the ultimate violence of this supreme being that supposedly is taking care of us and watching out for us, killing its own child. I mean, how comforting is that? And when, you know, when you think about it, it's just very odd to think about this religious system or whatever, that the central symbol of it is a cross, a way of killing someone. And then just the violence that the church has committed, the Christian church has committed against, well, women in particular, but, you know, also against everyone, I think, but since we're talking about women, that's what I'm thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Matter and Scott have anticipated what the session I'll do this evening in a couple of ways. The big conclusion, okay, here's the grand finale for today, for this session. In cases where we are not specifically naming violence, we as a culture are sanctioning it. We as a culture have built into ourselves ways of affirming violence rather than disaffirming violence. From the very structures of romance, the idea that the man is strong and decisive and comes charging in on the white horse, and the passive damsel who is weak and fair must be rescued. You know, our whole imagery of dating and the like is at the very base a part of a cultural sanction on violence toward women. It sets us up into certain stereotype roles. Let's keep that idea of the sanctioning of violence by our culture in what appear to be innocuous things, like our style of teaching, for example. You know, I never thought of my good-hearted New Testament professor as being violent until I began to reflect about what violence really is. But isn't it significant that he would come into class every day, put in exactly as the bell rang, put his notebook down, open it up, read until exactly the minute the class ended, close the book, and walk out of the room, never looking at our faces and never asking if we have questions.
And then grading you on how well you were able to.
That's right. Yeah, we were being graded on how well we could keep up, not on whether we were learning anything at all. I like him anyway, but that's only because I got to know him in other circumstances. If that was my only impression, I would have seen that is a style of teaching that perpetuates violence, putting all the power in a single authority figure and letting other people just fend for themselves the best they can. So think about how you, I mean, this is hard work. I have to think about every single thing I do anymore. If I'm going to teach and talk about this stuff with any authenticity at all, I have to be self-reflective and self-critical. Now, the segue into the next section is that what is religion but a part of culture? And I want us to think tonight about how it is, as good Christians, we in fact are involved in sanctioning violence of all sorts. But in particular, we'll think about how we sanction violence toward women because of the things we do and the things we think. Just one last item of business is this. This retreat can, a topic can invite people to participate for many different reasons. You know, intellectual curiosity, some of you haven't seen me since January, and you're being polite, and others of you may be here for specific reasons, because you are struggling with the violence that is in you, with the violence that you do or with the violence that you have experienced. And for that reason, I think it's a good idea to raise this question with this group. Do we need an afternoon meeting? I think Margaret and I said around 2, for women only, or a session for men only to talk about this. We could set up a schedule so that I could facilitate both, or we could decide that there's another male in the group who would be a better facilitator for men. We might want a different voice from a different woman to act as facilitator for a women's group. And I would recommend that it not be a formal thing, but it be a kind of context where people can come to voice about the things they are thinking and feeling about the topic. What is your pleasure on this?
I would favor a 2:00 session, okay. And I would be very happy with you as the facilitator.
Okay. Are there people who would like to do this?
So you're suggesting a 2:00 session for women only?
That as an option, yeah. But at the same time, there could either be a parallel session or one later or at another time for males only who want to talk about violence. And we've obviously worked our way into the ambiguities of being male and dealing with what violence means in the lose-lose situations because of our structure. This is not something I want to coerce into happening, but I wanted to make space and opportunity.
Oh, I would favor 2:00 session also. And I guess from my perspective, I would like to see an informal session, and it doesn't have to be women only or men only, where I throw that idea out.
Yeah, that's true. That is
because
a good option.
Yeah, I think an informal session, mm-hmm. and it could be women only. That would be a different role than a mixed.
The only reason I suggested segregated sessions is that there are some women I know who are so close to experiences of violence right now that they have difficulty talking about them in a mixed group. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as much as I try to reconstruct society and make it the case that men and women can talk to each other, one time I taught a graduate seminar in women's studies, and as it happened, it was a class with maybe 8 people in it. As it happened, one day all 3 men weren't there for legitimate reasons. And the character of the discussion changed entirely. Mm-hmm. Women were free to say some things that they had felt inhibited about saying around the men who were in the classroom because they cared about those people as men. But there were definite forms of anger and concern that they needed to express and analyze, you know, at the graduate level that they weren't getting to do. So that was the only reason I suggested separate sections.
That's reasonable.
Yeah. And 2, I think because we have very generous-hearted men in this particular community, that it might be difficult in a group session for men to raise the issue of male bashing, for example, for fear that suddenly this barrage of powerful, voiceful women will come down on them. What do you mean, male bashing, sort of thing. You know? And there are imaginative ways that men need to think and analyze